And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
Henry David Thoreau said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." So it logically follows that if we want to preserve the world, we have to preserve wildness. 43 years ago, Congress created the Wilderness System to protect and preserve the wildness. In recent years, these and other public lands have been at the center of a fundamental tug of war between those who believe such places are meant to provide resources for profit and those who profit in other ways from their being preserved in their natural state. What is the state of the wilderness? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
I've come recently to have a new appreciation for wilderness. Why? Because if you take the time to think about it, wilderness, particularly as we have defined it in the United States, is the closest we have, and likely ever will have, to a manifestation of God, or truth, or the Great Spirit, or the divine plan, or a tribute to the natural law or natural selection, literally in the world. American wilderness holds the seeds of genetic diversity of our realm, diversity which is beginning to crash in the sprawling reaches of human development, and even in what was, until recently considered, the jungles of deepest Africa or along the Amazon. To be frank, what is needed suddenly around the world are comparable wildernesses where no roads are cut to allow the cutting of trees or the mining of minerals, where no one can live to slaughter gorillas or orangutans as bushmeat. Had we set up oceanic wildernesses much earlier, the sanctity of its diversity might still be intact. Large fish and whales could live within the natural rhythms of life that have allowed us all to know of them, even if, perhaps a few generations on, they will thrill us only in legends and museum mounts, in old DVDs, films, and stories. Wilderness is the repository of the truths of our existence, and a time may come when we redefine what it means to talk about the spirit of wilderness. It's conceivable that we may, in the future, turn to wilderness as a sacred place in which the greatest wisdom, power, and magic of the universe live. And it may be that a time comes when we unite with its deepest truths, once again, as we have in the past, through the great legacy of naturalists, transcendentalists, and writers, the Thoreaus and Emersons, Whitmans, Carsons, Muirs, who expressed this truth and helped to enshrine wilderness when there was a chance to speak freely from the soul of humankind. So today we take a look at what is happening to the wilderness movement with one of its deepest apostles, Mike Matz, executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. That will be coming up in segment two of today's show following the Weekly Earth Summit. Coming up in just a moment, we get an update from Donna Buckby from Rushford, Minnesota, one of the towns devastated by the torrential rains and floods exactly 1 month ago. Donna continues to share the recovery of this Midwestern American town as it tries to restore itself enough to endure the oncoming winter that in that part of the states is already being felt. That's all coming up. But first, we bring you this week's edition of the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is your host, Sidney Wildsmith, and we continue to get updates from our exceptional panel of experts in science, advocacy, and nature. The world is a complex place, as you'll certainly learn in the upcoming news report. And those of us who work and dedicate our lives to keeping this whole thing going sometimes need to take a look at that age-old question, do the ends justify the means? It's a value judgment, but a newly activating advocate is taking a personal stand to do the right thing. So I want to begin today's summit with Ben Lowe. Ben?
I've got a confession. I love to travel. I love going to new places, experiencing cultures, meeting people. I've hopped an airplane for about 6 round trips each year in college. Last summer, I flew over to Tanzania. There's nothing unusual about this. My generation really gets around. We now have unprecedented access to all parts of the globe, and we've taken advantage of these opportunities. We'll hop a plane at the slightest excuse. This summer, one of my roommates is in Russia, the other's in the West Bank. I have friends and classmates that are in almost any country you can think of, even places like Sudan and Tibet. But we really need to rethink this travel happy trend, and it needs to start with me. First off, I need to figure out how to cut back on all this flying, really cut back. Then I need to consolidate meetings and road trips so that they accomplish more on less energy. When possible, I need to take trains or buses. As an environmentalist, I am convicted that it's time for me to clean up my own act and set a good example. After all, it sure seems hypocritical to be burning up the earth by flying to a meeting to talk about saving the earth.
Thanks, Ben. And in that same vein, I'm proud to announce that the weekly Earth Summit has one of the lowest carbon footprints of any global forum, as our guests travel here and speak to you each week without having to even drive a tenth of a mile to do so. Now that's keeping our eye on the message. And speaking of eyes, I recently talked with Dr. Mark Beckhoff about the power of eye contact in communicating with animals, and Mark has offered to share his observations. Dr. Beckhoff.
One of the things you mentioned about that interaction is eye contact, and I think that that is very, very important. You know, sometimes you can invite interaction, and other ways you could repel it by direct staring of the eyes. But I think when you relax your eyes and you roll them around and sometimes you move your head very slowly, that also is an invitation to interact friendly. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a play signal, but that's another thing I've done with cats is, especially with cats who I don't know, basically you can look at them, you can break eye contact, you can roll your eyes around and certainly not stare them directly head on. And it's fascinating how you can get them to do that.
We're going to keep up our dialogue on animals and their wonderful abilities with Dr. Beckhoff in the months ahead. Animals and their amazing diversity and behaviors has a champion in Dr. Robin D. Moore with Conservation International, who invites you to join him in his efforts to awaken the world to the plight of the amphibians. Please welcome Dr. Moore.
New Zealand contains only 4 living species of frog. 3 species have already gone extinct. Those surviving species are among the world's most ancient amphibians, having remained virtually unchanged for around 200 million years. They are unusual in that they communicate using chemicals and only have limited hearing ability. They very rarely swim, but when they do not kick their legs in time like most frogs. These frogs are restricted to small areas of native forests in the North Island of New Zealand. They are, like a third of amphibians around the world, threatened with extinction. The good news is that they're the subject of an intensive conservation effort, which is having some success at reversing trends. An awareness-raising campaign is informing the public about these bizarre creatures, and the creation of reserves and habitat restoration is protecting their habitat. As a result of these efforts, a new population of one species has been found, and other populations do appear to be expanding. These successes speak to the value of a truly collaborative effort among scientists, zoos, and local groups, and serves as a model for projects elsewhere. To learn more about this and other amphibian news, you can read Froglog, the bi-monthly newsletter of the Amphibian Specialist Group. This is available at www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Please do visit his website. If you've not ventured into the wonders of the amphibians, it's definitely time you did. We're always pleased to hear from Dr. Charles Kennel. This week, Dr. Kennel applies his penetrating perspective to remind us all that there are no simple answers. Dr. Kennel.
I think the most important thing is that if you are worried about the next 100 years on our planet, then you'll need to predict how our global environment is going to evolve. And the minute you do that, you begin to understand how interconnected all the parts of the Earth system are. You can start any place in the Earth system and go around the loop. The oceans transport heat from the tropics to the poles, and that this ocean transport of heat is one of the major drivers of climate. Some of this energy gets into the atmosphere and powers the storms and the freshwater cycle. The sun shines down on the oceans and atmospheres and warms them and is the ultimate driver of climate. The parts and pieces are tied together. And when we start interacting with the climate, we do so on a global and interconnected basis. When we put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, it spreads completely around the Earth and blends in with the contributions of everybody else on the planet who are burning fossil fuels. And this carbon dioxide then heats the globe. On an average basis, the temperature is rising 1 or 2 tenths of a degree per decade. But that masks the interconnectedness of the parts of the climate. Some parts of the world are going to get drier. Others, particularly the tropics, may get wetter. There will be more energy circulating in the climate system. People now think that while the number of storms may remain approximately the same, they will probably get more intense over time. As we warm the surface of the Earth, the glaciers are retreating, the snow melts in our mountains are retreating, and the snow cover is retreating. And we're affecting the freshwater cycle through the melting of ice. The melting of freshwater that has been on land, such as in Greenland and Antarctica, when that gets into the ocean, that is beginning to contribute to the rise of sea level. When sea level rises, our coastal environments and our beaches and our beachside cliffs and our homes become more vulnerable. And it isn't only the few centimeter per decade sea level rise that we've seen that makes all the difference. It's when the sea level rises in the background and great storms cause storm surges to go across our land. I was just in England, and a good deal of London is only 2 or 3 meters above sea level. And so we have chosen to build much of our civilization next to the sea. 50% of the world population lives within 100 miles of the ocean. And so most of our human activity is taking place just where the sea is about to encroach on all that we have done. When we burn fossil fuels and other fuels inefficiently, we create smog and aerosol particles. And the natural winds pick them up, and they transport them across the ocean. When there's a major smog event in Beijing, it arrives off the coast of California. About a week or so later, we can detect all of those particles in our atmosphere, and at those times, they are three-quarters of California's upper air pollution. When the winds blow off the desert, in Africa, and they transport sand and dust to the islands of Jamaica, there's a rise in pulmonary diseases and asthma. And so our entire world is interconnected in ways that we had no idea until we started studying it at the Earth system as a whole in the last 50 years. And it is clear to us that nature has created a greater interconnection amongst its parts than we have as a human civilization. And it's the fracturing of our civilization and the lack of communication and understanding and the inequality around the world that gets in the way of our being able to stabilize the environment of this great planet so that we can live on it as a harmonious civilization for centuries to come. Nature is more integrated and more tied together than we are.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I look forward to hearing from you each week here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Sometimes it's hard to know if we're making enough progress to meet these challenges. We're all glad to know that the faith-based communities are awakening to a renewed sense of responsibility to care for the gift of life on Earth in its broadest sense. Dr. Matthew Sleeth announces a personal milestone on his path to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
The big change for me is now being the U.S. director of this Christians in Conservation. AROCHA, which is capital A, capital R-O-C-H-A. AROCHA means the rock in Portuguese. And the tagline has always been Christians in Conservation. In the United States, we're moving the tagline to be the title, Christians in Conservation. It's in 16 countries, and there's like three or four more pending right at the moment. But it's everywhere from Kenya to Brazil to India to UK, Canada, United States. In the U.S., it developed as a way to send money to the other AROCHA sites around the world. But there wasn't really a vision for what it was going to do here. In other countries, it does a lot of field biology work. They rescue estuaries, things like that. And in the United States, there's some of that going on. There's a project in Washington State. The blueberry crops are being decimated by starlings. And one of the AROCHA scientists figured out that you can use kestrels, which are really territorial, to chase off the starlings and not have to use any poisons and that sort of thing. And in the U.S., they've had a board. They've had great members and lots of very generous people, but they haven't had somebody with a vision of where it should go in the U.S. I've taken up the job of leading that organization in the United States, and there's just great people with a great vision, and they love to combine science and conservation and their faith of Christianity. And that's what's up and new with me, and it's a challenge, but it's a wonderful challenge. And I get emails from all over the world now, people, you know, pulling for us and praying for us here. And that's encouraging to realize how big this family that not only shares my faith, but my love of the creation is.
Many people are joining this effort to serve the Earth for various reasons. Some because they've sensed the need. Some because they're becoming adults and the world is theirs if they can keep it. To them, and to all of us, there is so much to learn. Dave Foreman now joins us to offer his years of devoted study and focus his attention on a great new book about wilderness. Dave?
I'm going to be a little different this week and give a book review. I'm a great lover of conservation books. I have about 3,000 in my library. And on the Rewilding website, rewilding.org, we have a feature called Books of the Big Outside, where I give short reviews of the most important conservation books around. We have about 350 books listed right now. And I also do Uncle Dave's six-pack of the best books recently. And for last year, 2006, the book that won the best conservation book of 2006, in my opinion, was The Last Great Wilderness, the campaign to establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay. I envy my friend Roger Kay. As a wilderness manager and the bush pilot for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, he has had wilderness experiences most of the rest of us can only dream about. Knowing our flagship wilderness in all seasons and moods has led him into thinking deeply, perhaps more deeply than any living person, about the host of values wilderness holds. Roger's deep exploration of wilderness values comes through in The Last Great Wilderness. I read the book on a 3-week canoe trip in the Arctic Refuge last year and was mightily impressed. In a short review such as this, I cannot begin to do justice to the book. But let me point out just several features of the book that make it a standout. Arctic Wilderness is the detailed history of the decade-long campaign in the 1950s to set aside a big chunk of northeastern Alaska as some kind of wilderness preserve. In recounting that history, Roger plumbs the values that captivated and drove the various conservationists, giving us the most intelligent and thoughtful review of wilderness values in print. Conservation histories too often focus on the same cast of well-known, to literate conservationists anyway, characters. For example, Olus and Marty Murie are seen just about by everyone as the leaders and key players in that campaign for the Arctic. Roger gives the Muries their due, but brings out the other worthies of the campaign too, particularly Lowell Sumner and George Collins of the National Park Service. the two greatest conservationists of the 20th century that you never heard of. And beyond the big players, Roger gives grassroots activists center stage. Quoting extensively from them, he shows that Alaskans, like bush pilots Jenny Wood and Celia Hunter, were original wilderness thinkers who didn't need to rely on experts. And he shows that hunters in Alaska in the lower 48 were a significant force behind protection. Roger also gives a fair portrayal of the opponents of protection, insightfully showing how the opponents and supporters use competing concepts of the last frontier to bolster their arguments. In order to showcase such views, Roger's research involved reading personal letters, hearing records, letters to the editor, and conducting interviews with still living folks on all sides. What interested me most, though, was how Roger discussed values. Evolution was the key thing to be protected in the eyes of Sumner and Collins. They and others saw that only an immense wild region could protect the ongoing process of evolution and all of its building blocks. Quote, Sumner expressed the hope that this place might always have, quote, freedom to continue, unhindered and forever if we are willing, the particular story of planet Earth unfolding here, where its native creatures can still have freedom to pursue their future, so distant, so mysterious. Do read The Last Great Wilderness.
Be sure to check out Dave's critique of over 300 books about nature and the environment on the Rewilding website at www.rewilding.org. A reminder that the Weekly Earth Summit is open now to anyone out there who has something important to say about nature, the environment, and the future of this planet. If you wish to share your voice here, contact me at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. You too can be heard on the most important 15 minutes on Earth. It was almost exactly a month ago that Rushford, Minnesota was hit by some devastating floods that resulted from unusual torrential rains. At the time, we talked with Donna Buckby, who lives in Rushford, Minnesota, but not the high country up in the hills surrounding the town. She hadn't really had a chance to get down to the town to see what the damage was. She was preparing for that. And then we followed that up with a report a week later, where we heard what had happened to the town, and here we are a month out. And I want to follow this story because the restoration of a town, Midwestern town, like Rushford, I think is an important story because I don't think it's the last time we're going to hear about this as we look at the potential changes in climate, et cetera, coming from climate change. So, Donna Buckby, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, Donna, it has been a month, and I'm just curious if you were to summarize where things are, and we're going to go into more details, what really stands out for you?
Well, I guess it's amazing for me just to see the categories of debris that can be taken out of a building. It changes from day to day and week to week, and they haul all that away, and you think, okay, that's done, and people can start rebuilding or actually tearing down their homes if they've been condemned. But then, no, then more stuff is brought out, and there's piles up and down the streets, and they haul that away. But now I'm seeing a lot of duct work and cement blocks and brick and flooring and lath and ceiling tiles. So hopefully this will be the end of it, and the debris will have been hauled away, and then the real reconstruction can begin, or else the final demolition will start. Mm-hmm.
Give us a, by the way, let's review for people who perhaps haven't followed this from the beginning. Rushford, the population, and then how many buildings and homes were seriously impacted by the storm?
Well, Rushford has about 1,500 people, and there are slightly over 700 homes in Rushford. And I've heard anywhere that 150 to 275 homes are going to have to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. So about a third of the
yes.
A third, yeah. Well, that's a lot. That's a lot in a little tiny town like that.
It's devastating for the town, and everyone is living in so much with so much uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And you had talked about that winter was coming. Mentioned that a couple weeks ago, and there was a frost late last week, and that put the fear of God into everybody.
Well, it does, because you die.
Yes. Well, people do have homes to live in now. They've all found relatives to stay with, or they've got trailer homes or temporary housing, or they're being put up in apartments. But if the homes are gutted, and you can see right through some of the homes, and they're, if these homes are going to be ready for winter, their time is not on our side right now. We could have a early winter.
Where are you in that process? So that's interesting. You talked about the process of clearing out all the debris. This is a process of kind of getting the homes ready, homes and other structures ready for rebuilding. Are you nearing the point where you can actually start? I imagine some homes are. It depends on the situation. But are you reaching that point?
Yes. The look of the town is changing. And now, instead of people coming in to do the grunt work and hauling out the debris, now there's a need for more skilled labor. So the sheetrockers and carpenters and plumbers and electricians are coming in.
Now, they would have to be coming in from outside the community, wouldn't they?
Well, no, some of the people are local.
Right.
And that's preferable, although there are people coming in from other parts of the state and the country, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this is paid work yet, I'd like to know, or if they're donating their services.
One of the things about people in small communities is that people have real expertise and can do a lot of the work, the carpentry, the plumbing, the sheetrocking, but it sounds like you've really got a lot of work there, so I can't imagine that your local population could really handle all that work.
Oh, no. No, it would take too long. People mm-hmm. need help from the outside.
How's it coming along? And then also, how in the world is this being financed?
Well, no, there are still lots of, tons of volunteers coming from all over the state and all over the country, and even some people from around the world are coming to help and donate money. A group of Buddhists came in from Taiwan a couple weeks ago and were handing out just cash to people if they could show that they were truly residents of the city and been damaged. But no, there's still tons of volunteers coming in, and I'm going, like I told you, I'm going down to the kitchen at the Catholic Church. It was the only kitchen in town that was left unscathed, and so they're feeding all the volunteers and the people in town who don't have electricity or running water. The town is full of volunteers still. One of the things I want to tell you, the parents in town have been told not to let their kids play in the grass because it's contaminated. But then also, the dust in town, when the wind comes and kicks up the dust, my friend Bob said, Donna, that dust isn't just dust. So we're concerned that there's going to be health issues down the road.
Hmm. So are people wearing face masks and things like that?
There are people living in town. There are kids out in the playground. The school is running. I'm not sure that was the wisest thing to do, but kids are out in that playground.
Well, you know, I can recall growing up in the Midwest, you never wanted to really stand out and feel and be awkward. You didn't want to be the odd man out. And so I can imagine kids just really won't wear face masks.
Kids aren't wearing particle masks, no.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
And I can only advise them, if they're listening, to do so, because I'll tell you what, as you get older, that's when it comes back to haunt you. Some of these dangers take years to develop and show themselves. So if you get it, just go ahead and do it. You know, it's really important. It just really is. They certainly learned that after the 9/11 disaster and the workers there and other places too. You know, so that's important information. When we last talked, you were trying to figure out how in the world to get food to your town because the grocery store was down. What's the status on your store?
It's going to be rebuilt. They're working on it right now, and I think the shelves are going to go in early October, and they might be up and running in another month and a half. This is wonderful news. And one of the restaurants has opened. The Subway is open, and I think Judy's restaurant is going to be opening maybe in a month and a half.
So how do you get your food? What's the process of that? You have to bring it in then?
There are lavish donations of food that are brought to the kitchen at the Catholic Church, which is feeding maybe 1,000 to 1,500 people a day.
A day?
Yeah, a day. Oh, it's amazing to be working down there. But there are buses taking people down to a town about 30 miles south of here to go grocery shopping. So people go to Winona, I'm going to Houston.
Well, it's obvious to me, and I can recall growing up in small, literally small towns, 410 people in Woodville, Wisconsin, for example, High Woodville. There was a pace to life there that was really very precious, but it sounds as if that's totally disrupted at this point in your town.
Absolutely.
If there is a focus on this recovery, what are some of the main areas that the town is really addressing? I'm curious, first of all, you need help. What is coming through at this point? You've talked about the volunteers. You've talked about the fact that some Buddhists are handing out money, but you need a lot of help. What help is coming through at this point, besides that?
A week ago, there was a special session. Governor Pawlenty was loath to call this special session, but there was so much pressure brought to bear on him from the people in the area and our legislators that there was a special session. I want to thank Ken Jumper, our representative to the State House, for all the work he did, because he got an aid package, a relief package that is the biggest and the fastest to hit the ground in the history of the state. And he also reminded Minnesotans, he said, this state was built on investments and not tax cuts. So the money is here. Now what we're worried about is that Pawlenty is going to make people jump through hoops. These loans that were going to be forgivable loans if people stayed in the area, now maybe they're not going to be forgiven loans. And so we're working on protecting the people and making sure that the locals get to decide how that money is spent.
Well, if we look back to New Orleans, where the devastation happened, and there are so many hoops, people are all tangled up, they don't know what to do. You know, this is not your fault. I just have to believe that someone understands that you people just plain need to restore your place, and red tape is inappropriate at this point. What do you think the package is that will come through?
The local people need to demand that they have access to that money, and they should have forgivable loans. But it was $157 million from the state legislature, and I'm so glad that there were enough people in the legislature at this point in time, people who cared about funding the common good rather than people care about tax breaks. But $157 million from the state and maybe another $50 million from the federal government to pay for roads and bridges, but there's going to be a new septic system put in town, a new sewage system. The historic buildings are going to be protected. There's going to be debris removal paid for and reconstruction paid for, inventory replaced, wells checked and wells replaced too.
In terms of the aid package, $157 million, is that for Rushford or is that for the state?
That is for southeast Minnesota.
No kidding.
And then there was some other, like drought relief for other communities, and then there was the fire, the big fire up in the Boundary Waters.
Hmm.
So that is shared, but the vast majority of that will be coming here.
Mm-hmm. That really doesn't sound like very much.
It doesn't sound like very much, but
it's a start.
It's a start, yeah. And in fact, the legislators who came down to talk about the relief package said that this, we're with you for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. The news cycles, it might be done with Rushford mm-hmm. in a week or two, but we're going to be with you through the long haul, and this is just a start. And that when this regular session starts, we can revisit this. We will revisit this, and this is just a start.
For those people who literally are homeless or their homes are unlivable, where are they now, and how are you handling that?
Well, I put my name on a list to receive people into my home if they needed a place. But I know so many people in town who are putting up relatives in their home. I talked to a woman yesterday who had 17 relatives in her very small home without running water and without electricity, and they were there for a week. They've all found other temporary housing now. But that story is repeated throughout the area.
That paints a picture.
Yeah.
That really does.
17 people, relatives staying in their home.
I'm good for maybe two or three relatives for 3 days with running water and all the amenities.
Yeah.
You know, I saw some great photos on the internet by Goodmanson. That's a good name from the Midwest there. And I have a link on the website. This was taken actually the day after the floods to show some of the damage. One of the things I noticed was there were any number of cars lying around that were impacted. I'm just curious, what can you tell us about the vehicles in the flood?
Well, I don't know how many were ruined, but I did hear just a few days ago that some of the cars and other, say, appliances, if people didn't try to start them up, that they could be salvaged. Some of them, parts of them could be salvaged and maybe even repaired. But if people were foolish enough to, well, I would have done it, to try to start the car up, it was ruined then because all that water got into the system. But they're going to be used for parts.
I noticed the silos, for example, that may have been impacted, and I imagine they're, you know, the silos are the mainstay of your community there. What's the status on the silos and damage there?
Well, one of the silos actually sort of exploded. It had dry soybeans in it, and the water got in at the bottom, and it expanded and just blew the whole thing apart. It's a steel silo. So I'm assuming that a lot of the crops, if they were in those silos, they were ruined.
Well, looking ahead here, we're going to keep talking with you on a regular basis because this is it's a real-life drama that's being enacted. At this point, what do you see, let's say, in the next week or two? What's going to be the focus? And I imagine it changes every single week.
It does. It changes from day to day. Well, they already have cut back at the kitchen. Instead of having three hot meals a day, they're having cold continental breakfast and then soup and sandwiches at lunch, and they're still doing a dinner. But they're kind of cut that back, and I think it's kind of sad because it's so important for the community to come together in this huge dining room and for people to share their stories and be supportive and just share information about what's needed and what's available. So it feels like a loss to me that the kitchen is going to be kind of cutting back. But then as the kitchen closes down, the restaurants in town will reopen, so things will be getting back to normal in that respect, but people's lives have been so disrupted. All the social networks are kind of crazy at this point. So I'm going to miss working in the kitchen, and I think a lot of people will miss having the kitchen there.
But if you have to go to a restaurant, and this is not a criticism, but I mean, if you have to go to a restaurant, then you have to pay. People who had jobs, how are they managing financially?
And I know exactly what you're talking about, but then I think they're feeling that, well, then when the businesses open up again, we want them making money again and to try to recoup their losses. But so I understand that part of it. But I think there's some people in town who are worried that this is maybe feeling a little too communistic, or people are getting too dependent on this big kitchen. And but really, it's a wonderful gathering place, and it really sustains people emotionally.
Mm.
Where does the money come from to buy? I don't know.
I've lived at many different levels in my life, and there were times when money for a meal was something that could be hard to find, you know, particularly if you were out of work, you know.
Right.
And so I just have to believe that there's people who are trying to figure that out every day of their life. And there's very proud people, too. And asking for help is not something that's easily done.
You know, it was very difficult for some of the people in Rushford to accept help and to have volunteers come through. Some people were angry with the volunteers at first because they just did not want to be receiving help and they didn't want the financial aid. But I think that's changing. I just think people need to realize that, you know, tomorrow you're going to be helping someone else out. And in the past, surely you helped someone else out who was in need. And so today it's our turn.
Well, it's a fascinating drama. Is there any special need that you think people could help out Rushford with at this time?
Well, you could send money to the Rushford Flood Relief Fund, and you could send it to Rushford City Hall. And the zip is 55971.
Donna Buckby, we'll talk again soon. I imagine you have a busy day ahead of you.
I do.
Well, let's talk again soon.
All right, Sydney, thanks.
What's happening to America's wilderness these days? We bring you an important update with Mike Matz, Executive Director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness, when your Voice of the Earth continues. Here on the Wild Side News.
Ready to get down and dirty to help keep America beautiful? Bring family and friends out to clean and restore America's parks, rivers, and trails on National Public Lands Day, Saturday, September 29th. Meet up with over 100,000 volunteers coast to coast and lend your helping hands for America's lands. Make it a date. For information on volunteer efforts in your area, visit www.publiclandsday.org. A message from the National Environmental Education Foundation.